This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Before I start asking Judith questions, I was hoping that you would take a few minutes to talk about the work for those who haven't had, particularly for those who haven't had a chance to see it.
Obviously, when you first enter the space, you come in through the street. And one of the things about Cairo Stories is that it's really meant to engage the street very directly. So we have a projection that at night is turned on with the video. And I think sometimes during the day, it's also on with the audio track. And that really becomes the entrance to this work, Cairo Stories. And Cairo Stories, for the benefit of those of you who don't know it, is based on 215 interviews that I collected in Cairo over about 10 years. And I went to Cairo maybe between 20 and 30 times, depending on how you count the times I went. And so it's a very long-term project. It was begun accidentally when I was visiting Cairo because I was representing the U.S. in the 2001 Biennale in Cairo. And when I was there, many women started telling me their stories, very intimate stories. And in 2003, I was invited by the AUC in Cairo, American University in Cairo, to make an exhibition. And the project had already more or less found me. So I decided to continue this project that wasn't a project yet with Cairo Stories. And then while I was there, and this is written about in an article of mine called Saeed Said, in 2003, the U.S. started bombing in Iraq just as I was beginning to interview on the streets in Cairo, and the U.S. government decided that I should go home. So I was put on a plane in the middle of the night and basically had to leave, which effectively ended the project. And then over the ensuing 8 or 9 years, I came back to Cairo numerous times to do and continue the interviews. The project started with women from the AUC, who are usually from the middle class to upper middle class, and then it grew into a much larger project where through them I met other women from other classes, and it took over the entire city in a certain sense, and that's why in that way I consider it a portrait of the city, because I really did try to engage with all of the communities that I could. And the map that you see here is another locator of how to look at the project, in that it lists all the many places where I interviewed people. And we had a whole team by the end of maybe at least 8 to 15 interlocutors, maybe 20 or 30 different translators, and then all of the women that I worked with, plus other people that I got to know. So in the sense of having a community, it did make a certain kind of community among these women, because one woman led to another, to another, to another, to another. Ultimately, right before the events in Tahrir Square on January 25th, 2011, I had begun to finalize the project, and we spent quite a lot of time working with the interlocutors, figuring out which stories to bring to life and which stories not to bring to life. And I was actually planning to shoot in Cairo, but because Cairo has become a gated community in many places, and because the sound stages are located very far out of Cairo, the transit problems proved insurmountable. And for lots of reasons, we decided that we shouldn't try to shoot there. And so I brought the whole production back to New York City. And that's exactly the moment, in fact, when the events of January 25th began. And I flew over quite a few people that were working on the project. And so we worked on the project in New York. We cast the actors. We worked on the language because the project's in Egyptian Arabic, which is the language of cinema, as well as in English. And so we spent 2 or 3 weeks rehearsing and then 2 or 3 weeks shooting. And during the latter part of the shooting, that's when the events of January 25th were taking place. And so then the project premiered in March of 2011 at the Sharjah Biennale. And so that's sort of the trajectory of the project. The stories that you see in this configuration, there are 15 stories in English and 15 stories in Arabic, and they're the same stories, but they're said in both languages, and there's no apology for the English and Arabic. They just appear and disappear in English and Arabic and alternate. And you can also read the stories in the diptychs that you see along the wall, and all 15 of the stories are here. So I think that's probably enough of an introduction.
Good. You stayed within your allotted time.
Tonight, I'm good. I tend to ramble. So I'm wearing a watch. So if I look at my watch, it's because I'm trying not to ramble.
Which I lent her.
Yes. It's very okay. Beautiful.
So,
and it matches my outfit.
So I wanted to begin by talking about Cairo Stories as a work of art, and to place it in the context of current debates about art and politics, art and non-art, art and life, the relationship between art and everyday life, art and politics, etc. Because lately, and this is largely due to the urgent situation we're in, right? Perpetual war, environmental catastrophes, extreme, scandalous inequality, all of the things that are troubling us so much. Because of that, many artists and critics are declaring the need for what they call often political art, which is a term I personally don't like for reasons I won't go into right this minute. But political art or art engaged with politics. So we hear demands all the time that art do something to bring about social change, that art be socially engaged, that art be useful, that it take part in direct action, and so on. And in 2008, the journal October, which many of you are familiar with, chastised artists for not responding to the invasion of Iraq because, according to October, supposedly artists hadn't organized agitprop type cultural activities. And I'll say more about this later. But the meanings of these terms that are being bandied about, such as the political, right, social change, for that matter, action, use, any of these terms, their meanings are not self-evident. They're uncertain, and because they're uncertain, they're open to debate. At least that's the position I take, that it's the uncertainty of meaning that makes democratic contestation possible. If God had handed down the meanings, then we couldn't argue with them. But since he hasn't, we can.
Depends on who you ask.
Right, exactly. And actually these terms, the political, et cetera, have been questioned and rethought for many decades by feminists. I mean, just think of the second wave slogan, the personal is political, expansion of the notion of the political, but also by political philosophers, psychoanalytic theorists, post-structuralists, a whole bunch of people who have tended to be political not by polemicizing or, in addition to polemicizing, problematizing the very notion of politics and what it is, and what the political is. So when those who are calling for art to be political assume that we all know what that means, and that we all agree on what that means, I think, and not only what it means, but where politics is located, what it is, you know, all of these big questions, when it's assumed that those really are self-evident, then I think we're in danger of politics becoming authoritarian, the authoritarian form. And so many artists and critics today act as though there is some pure politics that exists apart from, completely separate from, the aesthetic, you know, from art, and that art, in order to aspire to be truly political, should try to cleanse itself of the aesthetic, should, like, get rid of its artness. And you, Judith, have expressed very different ideas about the art-politics relationship. So I'm thinking of your essay, which you wrote in 2007. 2007, the space that art mm-hmm. made? 2007, Judith wrote an article called The Space That Art Makes. And it's a favorite essay of mine. I recommend it to all my students. I recommend it to you. And at least as I read the text, you ask a different question. And the question you ask is, what art, qua art, you know, in its capacity as art, what it can contribute to larger political struggles? And you talk about artworks that seek to be responsive to the world of which it's a part. And about those artworks, you ask this really intriguing question, which is, where does the art occur in those works? What is the artness? What is the art part? And then to answer that question, correct me if I'm wrong about any of this. This is my reading of your text. So to answer that question, first you sort of place yourself in a lineage of artists, beginning with Duchamp, who have conceived of art making not as the making of an object, but as the creation of an experience, or the provision of the possibility of an experience, mm-hmm. right? So you list Duchamp and Caprow and Irwin and a whole bunch of other people, Michael Asher, and you say that this kind of art, which creates experience rather than an object, or experiences rather than objects, you say that this kind of art does not simply occupy a space that's already there. Rather, this art makes a space, hence your title, right? The Space That Art Makes. That art makes a space. And you argue that this space is not separate from daily life, and not separate from the rest of the world. It's part of it, but it's also partially protected. It's a partially protected space. So it doesn't completely merge with everyday life or the non-art or the world outside. And you say that, and this I think is really, for me, maybe the most important point that you make, is that it makes a particular kind of space. And you say that the space it makes is the space of an event. So art makes a space of an event. And by event, I take you to mean a space in which something new or something different, something that's not already known, can be discovered or brought into existence, right? And this always reminds me of a performance that the French Fluxus artist Robert Filliou gave in 62, I believe it was, and Filliou is one of the artists you list as one of your artistic ancestors. And in this performance, which was, it was the performance of an action poem, and it was called L'autrisme, which, you know, could be translated as elseness or elseism or so, which is totally awkward. So we'll just, the French is better. Filliou himself said that this really can't be well translated into English. But in the performance, the performers First, they asked each other two questions, and then they went out into the audience and they walked around the audience and they asked each member of the audience the same questions. And the questions were, what are you doing? What are you thinking? And then, whatever people responded, however people answered, the performers said, do something else. Think something else. And I think I like this as a whole, I don't know, metaphor is the wrong word, but it seems to me to describe art, mm-hmm. what art does, you know, and this whole idea of an event. Something else, something different, something new. In your essay, you say that Phil Yu, this, producer of that performance, that Phil Yu used art to destabilize everyday life and to reconfigure it. And then you go on to say that the space that art makes, and this is your answer, this is your answer to where does the art occur? You've asked this question, where does the art occur? And your answer is that art consists of making space for a hitherto unthought configuration of reality. So in other words, it's a space to do and think something else. So I want to ask the question about Cairo stories, which is what we're talking about tonight. In light of these ideas that you've expressed, and mm-hmm. which I agree with, I thought you might talk about the kind of space that Cairo stories makes, and especially about where the art occurs in this work. So I'm really asking questions about form, mm-hmm. the form of the work, although, of course, mm-hmm. It's not separable from content, but I'm asking for things like, what kind of experience do you hope or do you think that this work creates for viewers, and how? That's the question of form. How mm-hmm. does it do it? Does it in some way make a space for a hitherto unthought configuration of reality? Why, for example, do you use the installation form? How does that particular format where, each part relates to every other part and viewers walk around and move in it, in the space, sort of enter the work itself, how does that help produce this kind of space that you're interested in producing? I have a whole lot of questions here, and then I'm going to let you talk. So why installation? Things like, what is the effect of having the heads emerge as disembodied from these black backgrounds? And then the big question, I think, is the question of use of actors. Mm-hmm. And I know that the initial reason you used actors was because the original speakers didn't want to be caught on camera. But given that reason, what do you think the effect of the use of actors is in terms of the meaning of the work and the experience of the viewer in seeing the work? Okay, that's it.
You'll have to prompt me through the questions.
Okay, well, but I'm really thinking about the form because of this question of mm-hmm. what art as art has to contribute. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I should maybe back up and say that article was written very broadly to address questions of installation for a particular site, which was an international exhibition that used to happen every 3 years or 5 years in San Diego, Tijuana. And it was designed to make a context for people to understand the function of installation when it was using extra artistic material, meaning material that isn't usually considered part of art. In other words, it was written in 2003, but it didn't come out until 2007. And so I was trying to make a case for all of this extra artistic material, meaning research, a research-based practice. And I was also very interested, and still am, in the notion of spatializing information. And that's still an ongoing interest of mine. So I wanted to set out an argument about how other artists have addressed some of these issues with conceptual art antecedents. And, you know, obviously, Thierry de Dove is here. And the Duchamp reference, of course, is very key, as were certain ideas about institutional critique and, you know, other things that have been circulating for quite a while within the terrain of what's called installation, which is a kind of catch-all term. And in my thinking about installation, I do something which I also do in Cairo Stories, which is I set what I call subject positions for the viewer, because I try to spatialize information. In other words, the question is, personally, I have a research-based practice, and so when I have information, I think about what form could it be delivered in, and what does that form mean, and how might we use that form, and how might we look at other forms to re-imbue them with new life. And so those are some of the issues I was thinking about around Cairo Stories. And so with the way this is organized, as I mentioned, the map is very key, because usually the map is at the end of the space. And you kind of, when you read a map, there's a kind of, in quotes, subject position for you, the viewer, to find that you go and look at the map when it's normally across the space. And you notice that Cairo is represented, and you see the names of all these places, and right away that gets you thinking, oh, what? Why are these places named, and what do they mean? And then as you work through the stories, you begin to have a sense that this is really about a specific place. And in a lot of the stories, we were really going for very emotional stories, not for the kinds of things that you would necessarily get from someone if it was a big crowded room like this and you were just having a conversation in public. These are stories that were intimate. And so I wanted to make places in the installation where you could have intimate relations with the stories. And that begins at the doorway when you come in. You hear it in the doorway and it reaches out to the street, but you can't always necessarily hear it. And similarly, when you look at the photos and the plasmas, like, it takes a little while to figure out that, oh, there's a photo and then there's a plasma playing a story and a photo and a plasma. And there's a kind of après-coup moment where you suddenly realize, oh, that photo and that story are the same, and that suddenly stages for you a notion about representation. And what does it mean, a photograph that's deliberately in a kind of shot in the sort of classical paint with light mode of 17th century painting, which these deliberately are. And then you all of a sudden see this character speaking to you. So in that sense, I try to make you think about these things in a different way.
So that explains the, in part anyway, the, yeah, the backgrounds and the
right
heads emerging out of darkness.
Well, and also this project is part of a larger project called Not Reconciled, which is based on the Straub-Hullier, the early Straub-Hullier film. And I started the project in 86, and the first iteration was for the Whitney Museum in 1987. And I showed it there, and it was about immigrant experience in New York. And so these big talking heads appeared and disappeared in the space, and the kind of ghosting of the image also made them appear and disappear in a very interesting way for what video was doing at that moment in time, which is not allowed.
And that was even more surprising.
Yes, much
because
more.
Because you came upon that and you didn't even know where. Well, the projector was hidden, right?
Right, it was trampoline.
So you didn't know where this head was coming from. It was speaking to you in the staircase.
Yeah. And for this one, since I've done many versions of this project, I wanted to play with what can happen in a gallery. Because I see this work as actually the conversational elements, what we're doing tonight and all the public programming, is a really big part of the work. And when I talk about in that text and what Rosalind has just mentioned, this notion that art is an event, I mean that it happens between a viewer, a subject, a user, at that moment when they suddenly encounter the work and they're there. And, you know, and obviously it doesn't happen all the time.
That's what, like, what Badiou calls being seized by the event, right?
But it does, you know, hopefully it happens once or twice when you're in an exhibition or it doesn't happen to you. But I try to make the user of the work engaged and active as a participant as much as I possibly can.
So that also relates to installation.
Yes, very much.
Where you have to, the viewer is required to be active, in, at least in the sense of moving.
Right. Well, you have to construct the installation as you walk through the space.
Right. You're not just contemplating in front of a single image.
It's not transcendental in that way. And so, you know, I think for people who work in installation, you realize that how you set up the space and how you spatialize information is really crucial to how somebody will experience the work. And I always tell my students that that you cannot overdetermine an installation space. It's almost impossible because everybody will approach it very differently, and you can really set a place for people and you can hope that they find it, but they may never find it. So it's, you know, and sadly we all know, all of us artists here probably know that all too well.
That you have to presume some commitment, too, on the part of the viewer.
Yeah, definitely.
So to continue with this idea of, you know, the art-politics relationship, another word that's bandied about a lot these days is activism, right? And, you know, especially, you know, in the left or in the left part of the art world, you know, there's almost a frantic insistence on action, you know, on artists making activist work, you know, ignoring, I think, the fact that it is necessary to think before you act, or should be, or at least, you know, you would think that that's important to understand how to act, to understand what you're up against, all of these questions. In kind of standard activist rhetoric, action is really privileged over speech. So the two are opposed to each other. You know, it's very close to the culture of war, where action suddenly, you know, action over speech. You know, I've long thought that we need to rethink this term and actually think about it, right, and not just assume we know its meaning, of activism, given, you know, that action has been rethought, speech as action, and goals, what are our goals, things like that. These are all keywords of rhetoric, activist rhetoric. So I'm just wondering, would you call Cairo Stories an activist work?
Not really, but I wouldn't, you know, I have loaned it to activist causes. When somebody said, I'd really like to use one of the stories for this or that event. But I really think it's not designed to be activist per se in the kind of agitprop way.
Oh, no. Definitely not in that way. But what I'm suggesting is that that way needs to be expanded.
Right.
But I mean, I would call it activism.
Yeah, I would say that I think culture works in a very different way than most direct action work, because it doesn't necessarily expect an immediately deliverable goal. It actually works across multiple registers and in different time senses, and so you can never really predict the outcome ultimately of an artwork 100%. And, you know, there are many examples where an activist work has taken on many different characteristics over time. It's been perceived one way in one time and a different way in another time. And that also, I think is something that happens to an artwork.
You know, I'm thinking about the way the word activist gets wielded almost as a weapon sometimes, mm-hmm. like that's not an activist work, mm-hmm. which throws the work into the opposing category, which is quietist, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly this is not a quietist mm-hmm. work.
No, it's a cacophony of voices.
Aside from that.
but I like it when it's all on.
You know, but what
time.
I'm saying is that the way activist gets used is to define anything that's not whatever direct action is, you know, making posters mm-hmm. for demonstrations, let's say. It is to cast things that are not that into the realm of the non-political. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking
yeah.
about. So in that sense, do you think, maybe I'm forcing you to agree
no,
with me,
I think this could be stretched.
Yeah. If we stretch the word mm-hmm. activism and rethink it.
Which would imply a broader subject base than some of the activist groups, where they really want a much more directed action to be part of it. I mean, it's also been, I have used it a couple of times in communities where they've needed something, where they wanted to show women speaking. For instance, when it was in Munich, we did a big kind of public speak out with the work.
Uh-huh.
And it was used in that way, because mm-hmm. it was really interesting for the Turkish community to hear these other women speaking out. And that created a kind of a joint community between the Turkish community around Munich and the art community around Munich, which are actually very close to one another because Munich is a tiny city. And so that was a moment when I think it really had a kind of power. But I can see where it can circulate. I mean, the stories have been presented in places where there was no image, for instance, mm-hmm. and it was just the voices or text. And so, but I think what you're getting at is the question of a different kind of political body that would embrace something like this.
Yeah, of rethinking the whole notion
yeah.
of the political
yeah.
and the political in art and art in the political.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
yeah it's yeah. really an expansion of my whole
but
opening.
But I just want to say that I do notice a shift in political, well, there's less distrust of the art world than there used to be, which is kind of a negative. But when I first started as an artist, but it's a good day. I mean, it's getting better. I mean, slightly.
I haven't seen that, but okay.
Well, when I first started, there was so
much. I mean,
much
I'm just thinking about some of the, this is really getting off the top, off. But I'm just thinking about some of the rhetoric around Occupy.
Yeah, yeah.
The art aspect of Occupy.
Right, yeah. Well, Occupy is a different animal because it kind of went a little sideways, I would say.
But I'd say their idea is that art has to get out of the gallery, art has
right,
to be
exactly.
part of the demonstrations, protests, sit-ins, whatever,
which
are all great
things for
art to do. It's not that that's bad, but it doesn't have to do that to
right.
be political is what
it's,
I'm saying.
Yeah, I'd say it's both and or more. But
This piece,
but also the notion of what art can, art can function. I mean, I just wanted to say that when I was a young artist in the late 70s, early 80s, I would volunteer with all kinds of organizations to do their graphics or their posters. There are many artists doing this. You know, CoLab is another example, Jenny Holzer another example. And everybody would turn me down because they totally did not trust art. Mm-hmm. They couldn't control the meaning, and therefore it was suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and that was the moment when there was a big divide between art and popular culture. Mm-hmm. And that I've mentioned earlier in other conversations that was very fruitful, mm-hmm. I think, for artists anyway, to think through that gigantic divide. But I have noticed that one of the positive things about the collapse is that art is now just like every other thing in popular culture. It's just part of popular culture, so therefore it's not so suspect anymore.
But your idea that art is a somewhat protected space distinguishes art from popular culture.
I try. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But it also is not about art as high culture.
No, but
you know,
it's,
in the sense of you know the so-called autonomous transcendental,
it's
all
not,
of that.
Yeah, it's not autonomous.
So let's elaborate on the space that art makes idea by asking if the space that something like Cairo Stories makes is a public space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've written a lot about what it means to bring together the words art and the word art with the word public, or the word space with the word public. What does that mean? You know, we hear public art, art in the public interest, art in public spaces, all that kind of stuff. And what I've argued in my work, as you know, is that art doesn't become public simply by being placed outdoors, to put it really reductively. Art doesn't become public, in other words, by being located in some space that city government or some corporation has decided they're going to call it public, that it's preordained as public, you know? So I'm saying that I've said that artwork isn't public by virtue of its location, especially in these spaces like urban squares, corporate plazas, parks, whatever. And the reason I think that's important is that, to make that point, is that to call those works public, which is considered, you know, a good thing, public, to be public, to call works that are placed in those places public is to conceal the fact that those spaces are often very privatized, no matter what they're called, right? Mm-hmm. They're privately owned, or they're, you know, heavily monitored, they're policed, they're exclusionary, they are endowed with proper uses. And usually, free speech is not one of those that's considered a proper use.
Or reassembly.
Or assembly, or anything. So, for me, an artwork's publicness, its quality of being public, is not measured by its location, but rather by the way it performs a certain operation. And then here I get very close to you in the space that art makes, because the operation that I'm saying that art can perform is to make a space public. Vito Acconci says this: you either break or make a public space, right? Mm-hmm. That's what public art should do. It should make or break. In other words, break a space that's called public, show it's not public at all. There are a lot of artists who do that. Or make a public space. And the particular kind of public space that I've talked about art making is public space in the sense of a democratic public sphere. And a public sphere, you know, the public sphere as a category is defined in a lot of different ways. It can be defined as the realm of political debate. It can be defined as a place where the state is held accountable to the people. It can be defined as a place where people assemble and exercise the right of critical speech, which is, you know, central to democracy, the right of critical speech. And it has also been defined as where we are exposed to others, otherness, and respond to others rather than react against them. So all of these things. So here we have Cairo Stories shown in a gallery, the kind of the very space that many advocates of public art say is not public, right? The gallery or the museum, that art has to be outside of those institutions in order to be public. So when you say that art makes a space, do you think that something like Cairo Stories makes a public space in the sense of a public sphere?
Yes, I mean, I do. I think it makes a, because I think most people who go to art galleries, first of all, know that they are open to the public, especially the art gallery. And that's why I also thought this would be a good place. An art gallery would, an art gallery rather than a museum would be a good way to stage Cairo stories in this way, because it is open to the public and people can come. And mostly, with the exception of the Sharjah Biennale, this piece has been shown in gallery spaces or public spaces that don't charge admission. And that, you know, that's kind of an important consideration. I did turn down with great, you know, trepidation a museum show, but they charged a lot of money. And I decided for this work it wasn't actually appropriate. And they weren't willing to make any concession. So, but anyway.
But
I did, you know, but I think the point of the public is that you can, you know, art spaces are public spaces. And I think that's a point that isn't, you know, we kind of forget with all the talk about the art world is only being, especially in New York, it's only about the money and blah, 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 but it's actually not only about the money. It's one of the few places that you can go that doesn't charge you to be there. And you can even have a conversation about something else in an art gallery without people coming to tell you to be quiet.
But that doesn't mean that it's a public sphere.
No, it doesn't mean it's a public, but it is a public space.
It could be. I mean, I don't think any space is inherently public or private. It's how it's used.
Right, exactly.
And it's how you enter the space.
But so
what about this as a public sphere, as creating a public sphere?
I think it makes a public sphere for the audience who engages, and it doesn't for the audience who doesn't. Obviously.
Okay, so let's just stick with the audience that does.
Uh-huh.
Because if it's a public sphere, then it would be creating a public. It wouldn't be an audience anymore.
Right.
Because I'm thinking of audience as consumers.
Right.
Even information doesn't have to be product. Whereas a public is an active, engaged in dialogue, political debate, that kind of thing.
Right, right.
So do you think that this, for the people who engage, it makes them into a public?
I think so. I mean, I think, I've had a lot of, when I've shown it, I've had a lot of conversations with people that have come into the spaces where it's been shown, and it certainly makes a dialogue happen where they suddenly are talking about some of these issues. It brings up their travels in the region if they've been there. It brings up the stereotypical notions of the differences in women's experience, which if you read these stories really closely, you can see that these women have a very different experience of life than, in my opinion, and in their opinion too, than we do in the U.S. and Canada anyway.
And so the
and
viewer
Europe.
Is exposed to that.
And you're exposed, and so the aim is to make you think about some of those issues differently, as well as the aim is to make, in this public, the question of difference come to the fore instead of similarity. And
right.
The kind of, you know, we're all the same doesn't really produce much of a public, because there's no real dialogue then.
A public is based on conflict, you know, with
exactly.
conflicting opinions.
Yeah.
And Shelley's already got a question, but...
I know, it's
no, you're... I'm
it's
not...
Just, it's very quick.
Oh, could you wait, though?
Oh, okay, no, it's true. I don't
because I'm just about to up the ante here and bring in Hannah Arendt. So Hannah Arendt... Hannah Arendt famously calls, she writes about the public sphere, and she famously calls the public sphere the space of appearances, right? So, you know, she's writing this before Habermas came up with his concept of the public sphere. She says that it's, quote, the space where I appear to others as others appear to me. That's Hannah Arendt's definition. She equates the public sphere with the Greek polis, or the political community. and she calls it the space of appearances. So for her, people appear when they speak and act together. And her public sphere is not tied to any finite physical location. She calls it the space between people when they act and speak together. And this can accommodate the internet. Mm-hmm. She was before the internet, but it can accommodate all kinds mm-hmm. of things that Habermas thinks are the end of the public sphere. Just had to get that in. Okay, good. So, and she says that the public sphere appears when people act and speak together, no matter where they are, no matter where they happen to be, she says. So you could be in one party could be in Egypt and one mm-hmm. party could be in Philadelphia, right? Mm-hmm. And then Judith Butler builds on Arendt, and she says that when people assemble and speak together, especially for the purpose of exercising critical speech, and she wrote this particularly in response to Tahrir Square and other mm-hmm. incidents of the so-called Arab Spring, that when people speak together, they produce a public space. So that's in line with, you know, mm-hmm. what you're saying, what I'm saying. And I think a good example of that was Occupy Wall Street, what they did in Zuccotti Park. You know, you have this park in New York owned by a real estate developer that the Occupy people lived in. They exercised their critical speech there, we are the 99%, strike debt, all of that stuff. And they were kicked out because this is supposed to be a public space where you eat your lunch. You don't, that's what public space has been reduced to, I think, mm-hmm. in our country, basically, eating your lunch.
Is that a slogan?
Right. Well, they were eating their lunch. Anyway, but according to Butler's article was written before Occupy, but I think it's this idea that people produce a public space. She does it very eloquently. She talks about you gather the concrete and you make a public space. Well, their material conditions are there, but they're not a public space. You make a public space out of them. And she says that for politics to take place, the body has to appear. And so she's talking about Arendt, right, appearing. But she emphasizes, and this is inherent in Arendt, but she brings it out, that to appear, you have to speak, and to speak, you have to be heard. So that appearing means appearing to others, right? It's phenomenology, after all. It means you appear to someone else. And so the public space, in this sense, is a space where you're addressed. And I think this is bringing us kind of close mm-hmm. to Cairo Stories, mm-hmm. which addresses us. It's a space of address so that the body, or we could just say the person, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't think it has to be the body. Mm-hmm. Or it can be the body in this form, maybe. That appears is a social body because it is directed outward. It's directed outside the self toward others. So I guess my question is, does Cairo Stories produce an Arendtian kind of public space and a Butlerian mm-hmm. kind of public space?
Well, it's certainly interested in some of those same questions. And with Arendt, she writes so eloquently also about storytelling and the need to tell a story and the polis mm-hmm. coming out of the notion of drama and the way
that's so perfect for Cairo Stories
and the narrative. And mm-hmm. she also talks about as the polis comes into being and it's phenomenological, so it's always coming into being and until it's not anymore. Mm-hmm. She also talks about how important it is to make something ordinary extraordinary. And I do think that's one of the things that the space art makes does, is yes. it strives for that. And so in that sense, I very much relate to what she's talking about. And in terms of Butler, I think, you know, she's really talking about, the end of that text, which I realized today, is really a lot about the question of gender and how gender can appear and how transgenderedness can appear.
Transgenderedness?
Ness. And so she's really, I think when she talks about the body needing to be there, I sort of read into it this question of the politics of gender and gender appearing and disappearing and the right to appear as something and become something which can't be named and mm-hmm. which isn't necessarily quantifiable or known. And so I read it on a very personal mm-hmm. level for her. And what was interesting about Tahrir Square during the revolution, it's not a revolution anymore. It was a revolution, but it's not, it's been, it's now called, it's called many different things, was that all of a sudden the public space that was created in Tahrir was completely open. And women felt as though they could walk through that space and appear in a way that usually they could not. Mm-hmm. The Middle East, in quotes, and Cairo in particular, has a real problem with harassment. And there is one story in Cairo Stories about harass map, which is something that's come of age in the internet age, meaning that if you are walking in a street and somebody's catcalling to you or even is grabbing you, you can use your smartphone and you can locate on your smartphone where this happened. And this is with the app tracked to this harass map. And so as a woman, if you're walking through, Cairo, this is still going on, by the way, and it's a live site. You can go online and find it. It's called Harass Map. But you can actually see the streets that you might want to avoid because there's mm-hmm. something going on. And also it's been used lately in Cairo because of the real problems. If you wander into a demonstration, it's not a good idea. And so you kind of want to know what's happening mm-hmm. in the street. But during the events of January 25th, women could walk very freely through all of Tahrir Square, which was a very big square. It was totally crowded. All kinds of different disparate groups were in the square doing different things, and it was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And, so that was one moment.
That's where there was really important because
a public, where a public, a polis was made, mm-hmm. And enacted.
Yeah, because the Arendt and Habermas, and of course a lot of the classical theories of the public sphere are based on a very male-dominated model. Women couldn't appear in the polis. There was just, mm-hmm. they were on the level of slaves, etc. And so I'm thinking about, any public space, any public sphere involves in exclusions. Mm-hmm. Right, but there are certain groups that have traditionally been excluded, and it seems that what something like Cairo Stories does is allow, just like you're saying mm-hmm. the revolution in Tahrir Square, allowed those who are traditionally excluded to mm-hmm. appear.
One of the, I think I mentioned earlier that we did interview in a lot of these informal settlements all over Cairo, and Cairo is, I would say, depending on who you read, 40% to 60% of the population, which is, again, depending on who you read, 16 million to 24 million living in what's called informal settlements, and these are people who don't have states' rights. And actually, Judith Butler mentions it in mm-hmm. the article that we were just talking about, this kind of notion of statelessness and how to make a place for the stateless mm-hmm. to be visible. And one of the things about these informal settlements is that, in fact, they're actually highly organized, even though the state is constantly dismantling them and moving the people around. And so there are several stories that are part of Cairo Stories that are about life in those settlements.
Well, and do you think the settlements themselves are a kind of declaration of the right to be visible?
Yes, they are. You know, and they are often very visible, and some of them are quite wealthy, so that you wouldn't necessarily know that you're in an informal settlement until, mm-hmm. you know, someone says, oh yes, well, this was started 15 years ago, and, you know, it's been built up, and there's, you know, there are many, many, many kinds of settlements. And when you go on the map to try to find them, they're not mapped. They're not, you know, they're not there, and so you mm-hmm. have to, like, really piece together from different NGO studies, like the names of them and where they're located and so forth and so on. But they're very big and broad and do take up a huge percentage of the actual yeah. square footage of Cairo, and they're
well,
in
when
every
you're,
area.
When you're talking about them, I'm thinking about like homelessness in New mm-hmm. York, and I don't know what the situation is here in Philadelphia, but the state's attempt to keep the homeless or homeless people or what I call the evicted out of public space, so that not that anybody really wants to be in living in public space, but the idea of being there instead of in some shelter that you're confined to can be seen as a declaration of the right mm-hmm. to appear.
Exactly, yeah. And mm-hmm. and I think that's very much enacted in the developing world. You know, mm-hmm. where, or the emerging market world, depending on however you want to, whatever euphemism is being used at the moment, where because the resources aren't there and the infrastructure isn't there, which also, by the way, wasn't there enough to produce beyond the January 25th events, but because it's not there, then individuals and groups actually can enact a public and a public mm-hmm. space. And
yeah.
you know, it's very interesting, actually, when you look at it from an urban point of view. And there is a book that a colleague of mine, Beth Stryker, who's living in Cairo, did about, it's called Learning from Cairo. And it's all, you know, based on the Venturi book. Venturi's a local architecture hero, and so is his wife, Denise Scott Brown. And they wrote a very famous book called Learning from Las Vegas, which I'm sure all of you know. Anyway, many people have used that. And in places like Cairo, you see these urban developments that just kind of appear and disappear because you can actually mm-hmm. siphon power, and you can get brick, and you can build your own place because there are no zoning laws. And, you know, it's a very different order of being than...
Yeah.
than in a place like New York, where if you tried to erect a house in a public park, they would come and,
yeah,
you know,
you
would be stopped within an hour, maybe sooner.
So I'm just, I think I want to, you know, I don't know, we should probably leave the question of the space that art makes, because we've been talking about it for a really long time, but I want to say one more thing about it. You know, we've gone from making a certain event space to making a public space to making a space of appearances. And I just want to talk about ethical mm-hmm. space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because for me, this is all the politico-ethical.
Right.
That, you know, and Cairo Stories in mm-hmm. relation to an ethical space and art's ability to create an ethical space. Mm-hmm. And I'm defining ethics in a very... you know, Levinasian way, as responsibility to the other, the ability to, and responsibility in the sense of the ability to respond to the other, especially to the suffering of the other,
mm-hmm.
Rather than to react against
mm-hmm.
the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about this as maybe making an ethical space.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point. And you make that point in your book, Hiroshima and After Iraq, which everybody should read, which is about issues around war. And one of the points that you make is about public vision and about how this kind of space this, you know, an ethical space, a space where public vision occurs, is actually a space where you can actually produce an effect. And the effect is to destabilize a lot of the questions that we take for granted. And you talk about it in terms of triumphalist vision.
Yeah, that public vision being something different from triumph. You know, vision has been talked about in our field and in our discourse in general for so long as really kind of a colonialist, you know, taking possession through viewing. So that another kind of vision, which I've talked about other artists doing, but I think your work does too, is to create a vision that in some way is responsive rather than, you know, trying to possess.
Right, right.
So I think, you know, if you walk into this installation and you're serious about viewing it, that there's a certain ethical demand that's made on the viewer to respond, or maybe to witness. I don't know if you would use that term for this project.
Oh, definitely. We talked a little bit about Agamben's notion of the witness and the need for testimony,
and that being the ethical position.
And that, the idea of that, which is to really bear witness, but not to fall into a kind of victimized state. And so, you know, I think, you know, I thought about him and his and that book in relationship to the, these stories when I was collecting them, because I knew that work. And I do think that there is also, and it's true of a lot of artist practices, there's a desire to really destabilize representation. And so a lot of the choices in this particular project and in many artist projects have really tried to look at how one represents, such as the question of what does it mean to even take a photograph
Of
another person. And those questions really used to be part of art discourse, but are less so now. So I, you know, in thinking of, in doing this, for this project, I was really thinking back.
I think
to
one
those
way
issues.
Of putting that that might be helpful for people who aren't familiar with this discourse is Martha Rosler's notion of the victim photography, where the like taking a photograph of a bum on the Bowery, you know, they're a victim in, of society in some sense, but then they become the victim of the photographer. And the victim of the photographs. So, sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's absolutely. You know, the, that is that's called the Bowery into unequal descriptive systems. Inadequate descriptive systems. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that was very prevalent.
Right, and now people are turning away from it.
Yeah,
I know.
And so, you know, I think, you know, the notion of using actors, the notion of problematizing the stories, and the fact that they're in first person address. Which, you know, is the Althusserian notion of hailing you as...
Right, you're really addressed.
You're addressed, because it's you, you know, and it's... You know,
and yet they're actors, so there's no... you understand that there's a fiction, there, in the sense of a construction, that a representation is a fiction in that sense.
Exactly.
That it's not the actual person, it's not the world outside of the representation. So I'm getting worried that we're going over time, but there's one more. So I'm going to skip a bunch of stuff.
Okay.
If you'll allow me.
Yes.
And I have one, but there is one thing that's really important, I think, for us to talk about in terms of this work. I mean, for the last few years, you and I have been, in, you know, interested in the same question, which is what does art have to offer or contribute to a discourse of war resistance. And as I said earlier, this journal October sent around this questionnaire to a lot, you know, to a group of artists and critics. Judith and I were among them. And the questionnaire asked, and I'm going to read it here, I brought it with me, in what ways have artists, academics, and cultural institutions responded to the Iraq war, and can you give examples of oppositional practices? And so you responded, and in your you wrote a rather long description of Cairo Stories, and you said, and I'm going to read your quote, "How to respond to the war? What can I do? What can art do? My response to this war is the project, not reconciled, Cairo Women's Stories." So I just wanted you to, I just wanted to ask you to talk about the ways in which this work as a response to the invasion of Iraq and occupation, because it's Egypt, for one thing.
I think one of the issues that I discovered when I was in Cairo the first time, in terms of the role of women, was how central they are to the fabric of the culture, and yet they had very little visibility. And I started thinking, well, this would be a way to get people who are not, to get these, you know, stories of things that are not so well known, the role of women in a culture that's not very well known, and that certainly, you know, before 2001 or 9/11 happened, and before the war broke out in Iraq, they were much less known than they are now. But this, I wanted to do something that could address the stereotypes about women and bring a lot of their strength to the fore. And again, if you read the stories and spend time with them, you can see that the women in these stories have a great deal of power, much more in a funny way than the men do. And there's a couple of stories that are very explicitly about that. But I really wanted to make the role of women much more apparent than it was in the stereotype, which is that the women are, you know, there's the harem, you know, and the woman who wrote Reading Lolita in Tehran.
I don't remember her name.
But when her book came out, and she writes about growing up in a harem, kind of, you know, what the harem was and so forth. And so that was very popular at that particular moment when I started this project. And I really thought about that book and thinking, oh boy, that, you know, this is something that I really wanted to do. And so that was kind of the impetus for using the stories as a way to counteract the very, you know, masculinist narrative, which is war.
Which is, and certainly supporting that particular war.
And, you know, when we think about public vision, we need to have other visions that aren't just destruction and, you know, and that aren't just, you know, boys playing video games because they can't get into the space program.
And issuing death threats now against women who criticize. Did you read about that?
Yes.
In the paper today, that this woman had to cancel her talk at the University of Utah. I'm sorry? Okay, thanks. Because she's a scholar who writes critically about video games from a feminist perspective, and she's getting all these death threats and other things.
Yeah, I read that.
I mean, this is also like, you know, it's not the same thing, but this is Judith Butler is leaving Columbia. I don't know if you know that, because, you know, she's really sort of been forced to, because she teaches courses about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Some of these, you know, ultra-Zionist groups have been attending the classes, heckling her, death threats. She's had to have a bodyguard. She's going back to Berkeley. She can't live that way.
Wow.
Anyway, wow. I mean, this thing about you're challenging stereotypes, in particular female stereotypes, but that in itself seems to me to counter, you know, the kind of homogenizing treatment of the Middle East that legitimates what we do there.
Right.
Too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think the dialogue about a lot of these issues has been so sunk in a certain lack of a politic that it's just a very knee-jerk reaction, and you can't, you know, what the two stories that you just mentioned are really kind of horrifying.
They're chilling.
Because you wouldn't have thought that that would be happening. you know, now. It's not surprising that it's happening
I'm actually not surprised. I mean, I'm appalled, but I'm not surprised.
But it's kind of, you know, you can see how far, you know, how much more to the right the U.S. has moved in the intervening 11 years since the war in Iraq broke out, which is this, you know, the second Gulf War
Since 9/11.
And since 9/11.
And how more masculinist the discourse has become, how anti-Arab.
You can see it in a popular show like Homeland, which, you know, is also full of stereotypes and on every level.
Talk about that later. I may have a slightly different. Okay, but I think it's time we open this. Do you agree?
Yes, I do.
To the audience, and start with Shelley, because I silenced her.
No, this is going back. I guess we're pre-Arendt at this point and pre-Butler. That, you know, because people, one has a sense of public space is it's a space where people are in it and discussing actively. And, you know, what's interesting about this piece, and especially this piece without all of us, which is how it typically is, that it's almost a very solitary viewing experience, that you are one among all of these women, and you go individually to hear them one to one. And I guess I just want to say the importance for that. That, like, to get away from this idea of public, you know, Occupy, it was completely crucial that there were many people in that space, their bodies, their voices, et cetera, et cetera. But I think one thing that art could do, that plop art or public art in public spaces don't do, is this kind of intimate address, or also, you know, these women aren't here tonight, or they couldn't be here tonight, and yet here they are, and there are more of them than there are us typically. So I just wanted to say that.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point. Thank you.
But I would say also that it doesn't have to be that solitary an experience, because there's also the discourse that's generated by the exhibition, right?
Of course.
What's written about it, all of the public programming around it that Judith has said is really part of the work.
Well, you leave the work and you talk to people. So I'm not saying, I'm just saying,
you're saying that
itself, the way it's set up, is actually quite personal, quite one-to-one.
Right.
Because of the headphones particularly?
Well, I'm in front of someone whose
head
talking
is slightly bigger than mine talking to me for 3 minutes, 4 minutes. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there's an intimacy, you know, and then you know, even, I mean, sometimes I've they've been on, like different stories have been on, and here we usually have, I think, one on, and you know, all the time, so you can hear it. But the idea is to create this intimate space between you and the work where something can happen. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, been.
But I would still say that between the dialogue that's sort of, you know, implied between the viewer and any individual photo that's already a social space, at least, not, you know, just a just an individual space.
Right. Yeah.
Well, it's always a space of two, minimum.
Yeah.
Who does the calling?
Yeah, Aaron.
Maybe Jean.
Just a tiny little question, jumping on what Shelley said. What about the slight enlargement of the head? I think
you mean in the window.
Why are the women in the screen or in the photos slightly larger than nature? Slightly larger than
natural.
Actual one-to-one scale.
I wanted them to be, you know, presented in this kind of monumental way a little bit, not completely monumental, but I wanted them to be larger than life, to give them a kind of dignity, again, because women of the Middle East aren't imaged very much, and I really wanted to show how they could be imaged in a particular way. So here they're smaller on the little diptychs, but on those they're larger. And I wanted something that where I could play with the scale. And there is a version that's even larger, for another space that I made, where the plasmas are, these are 42 inch vertically, and the plasmas, or the other ones, were 60. But I actually prefer them smaller. But
are you able to control the length of the electric cord? Because that determines your distance vis-à-vis the image.
Mm. Yeah.
If you are wearing them.
The headphones. Yeah.
Were you able, or you just, took the standard length?
No. They're actually much longer.
Oh, I see.
And they're all hidden in those boxes that Ken Saylor designed, my partner, who you know. And we did think about all the details, being good, good architects.
The fact that you say they're larger than themselves, is that how you put it?
Yeah, larger.
You wanted them to be larger than themselves. Mm-hmm. It takes it out of the realm of the single individual, even mm-hmm. as it is individual. It mm-hmm. also exceeds the level of mm-hmm. the individual.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of interested in the relationship to cinema in this work and forms of cinematic spectatorship. Mm-hmm. We have actors here and storytelling and narrative. And I'm wondering the words active and passive have been, discussed in this conversation. I'm wondering how this work kind of unhinges that binary between active and passive spectatorship, which has often been cast as political and apolitical, mm-hmm. Because there is a kind of absorption mm-hmm. in this work that is asked of the viewer, mm-hmm. Quasi-cinematic in a way. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how it kind of ruptures that discourse as a kind of congealed around installations and experiences as a kind of absorbing the viewer, taking them away from the world. So it's a kind of, it's an unformed question, but I think there's a way in which this work asks us to occupy a kind of middle ground between those binaries.
Mm-hmm. To some extent, yes, because you fall into it and then it disappears before your very eyes. And so,
You mean when the image fades and the next one comes on.
And, part of that is also not wanting these stories to run together like the news, because, when I started working this way 30 years ago, there weren't video images everywhere. And now, you can't walk down the street without something bombarding you. And so back then, I also used 30 seconds and 1 minute separations between these stories at the Whitney. And oftentimes, people would come to see that work and they wouldn't see it because 30 seconds is a really long time when you're standing in a stairwell and there's nothing to look at. But for these, there was 30 seconds between the fades. And it kind of is a right amount of time to push you out of that falling into the identificatory relationship that you have in the cinema and back into the world that you're in. And then there's another one, and then you're asked once again to let yourself slide in because the face stays there and looks at you. And, you can decide or not, if you want to engage. So that was very conscious.
But engaging isn't necessarily identifying.
No, that's true. Yeah. I think, there are many stages. I guess identifying is...
Yeah, that's another whole really interesting issue in this, is how do you relate to to difference mm-hmm. without identifying and collapsing the difference between you and that other person.
Yeah.
And maybe the defamiliarization techniques mm-hmm. that you've used help mm-hmm. with that.
Yeah.
And the making of extraordinary.
Right. Well, also the dissentation devices of the acting.
The acting, them being actors, right.
And the...
Of course, people don't necessarily know they're actors.
Yeah, and that's okay, too, but... Mm-hmm. I wanted them to be convincing, but also there is a kind of built-in dissentation device mm-hmm. in the use of the actor.
Yes, definitely. But.
Thank you for this wonderful conversation, and since you seem to agree I'd like to
seeing through the, I'm sorry,
agree. You both seem to agree on the basic basic terms. I'd like to return to either the ethics or the politics of the presentation and ask Judy why we have only faces. And when we were talking about Levinas, I heard a possible answer for Levinas. After all, ethics is condensed in the face. Mm-hmm. And is that a reason? But one can also wonder whether there's not a suggestion of decapitation or something a little more sinister. Just faces floating in this dark background. Or if the body that is missing is not simply the text next to it or the story. Or maybe all of these, I don't know, all at once.
You mean the textual, the body being textual? No, I know you said it's, it could be the text, but that could mean that the body is textual.
Yeah, I mean, I designed these to be projected in a first-person address form more than representing the body. And so we did think about shooting them full body, but it just seemed very unwieldy to try to do that on a, I mean, you know, I would have loved to have shot them really all, you know, the entire body and had the choice of what to show in certain situations, but we just couldn't. You can imagine how many takes this was, and you have to do it perfectly. There's no editing in this. The only editing is actually between the stories. So this was a grueling, grueling process for the actors, and fully dressed in the kind of clothing that would be normally appropriate on the street to be shown right now in Egypt or anywhere else in the region would have been, you know, was beyond our our capacity. But I did think about, like, showing the whole body. And, you know, I would like to do that at some point, and if I, you know, ever get a chance.
We have a question in the back.
Well, piggybacking on that, the way I see each photo is coming out of the dark, giving voice, focusing on their voice. And I'm a social worker. I've worked in Philadelphia with women who are mothers, who have been victims and survivors of abuse. And I just love the focus on the strength of these women and giving them a voice. And my question is about how you accessed all of these women and how you, did you conduct all the interviews? It's incredible, really incredible. So I wanted to commend you and just hear a little bit more about how you identified all these amazing women. And thank you.
That's very nice. Well, as I said, I started with the students at the AUC, and through them there were about 20 or 30 that I was working with. This is back in 2003. And so through them I met other women who introduced me to other women who introduced me to other women, and so it went. And, you know, it kind of was exponential. And through many of the women were involved in the project from about 2003 up until it premiered in 2011. And so, and I still have quite a few people that I regularly correspond with who are located in Cairo. But, you know, somebody would say, oh, I have a friend that I really want you to meet, and she has an incredible story. Or I would get emails from people saying, the next time you're in Cairo, I really want you to come and interview me because I have something to tell you. And, you know, there's something to be said for telling your story to someone, especially around issues that are traumatic. And in London, there's a kind of trauma theater that's been very popular, or in England, and it's kind of a post-colonial endeavor where through speaking stories about these kinds of very personal events, it opens up a space in you and in the community where different things can happen. And it, in the discourse around post-colonial studies or trauma studies, that, you know, which it does have something to do with social work on a certain level, a lot of these issues have come up as people in the region where post-colonialism occurred have taken control of those discourses. And so I think there was some of that in operation, even though it wasn't called that while we were doing it. But it was, you know, it was a very interesting experience. And we would occasionally have, you know, depending on if we could get people together, we would have parties for these groups of women and get them together and have them meet each other and talk to one another. And so, you know, it was a very generative group. And there were men involved too, like William Wells from Townhouse was a major supporter, and there, you know, many of the people that were working there were part of it, as well as other groups from other, you know, even in Alexandria were part of it. So it was a big group in the end.
Mariel's question makes me think about this work also as a kind of history making, mm-hmm. you know, or you could say a intervention in history writing,
uh-huh.
you know, where letting, or in official histories, dominant histories, mm-hmm. where those voices that are not heard generally mm-hmm. emerge, mm-hmm. and also just the reminder that writing history is storytelling.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not some objective mm-hmm. discourse.
Yeah, I mean, not this project so much, but some of the other iterations, I have worked with local history groups.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in different, you know, in London I did a project in 91 about the gentrification and yeah. around the Hammersmith tube stop. And I worked with 5 or 6 libraries and their history groups, and you know, it was a really interesting experience. And there were many immigrant communities, and now, of course, in London, there are no libraries, so now they're idea centers. Yeah, Lisa, can no. Oh.
Thank you for this evening. It's really been quite enjoyable and very, very interesting and rich. I have a few questions, Judith. I guess building off of this woman's question behind me about the formation of the work post 9/11, because here you are, an American, a Westerner, going over to Egypt to procure these stories from women. And I guess being in a university setting, this would most likely bridge any kind of suspicion that mm-hmm. maybe women on the outside of that mm-hmm. sphere would have. And I think, I'm very interested just to find out, maybe was there any reluctance to open up to you in that kind of climate? Because if we were to reverse the situation, for example, you know, an Egyptian woman is coming to speak to American women, mm-hmm. I think there would be some, I think, mm-hmm. very interesting subtleties in terms of that mm-hmm. relationship. Because, of course, 9/11 created that kind of backdrop, which we're, I believe, still living with in a very magnified way. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to hear just about maybe those subtle things. And then also, I loved the way you talked about the viewer, the subject, and the user. And because I imagine those points being equidistant. So in other words, there would be a way to entry, or to make an entry and exit point in the work that's equidistant, mm-hmm. maybe even a space of indeterminacy. And so I wonder if, in terms of form, would that be somewhere in between art as social practice or art that's in the auction and mm-hmm. being, you know, sort mm-hmm. of on that, this almost art as real estate, for example. Mm-hmm. So do you think that space, viewer, subject, and user, is where form really exists as art?
Well, I guess I'll answer that one first. I mean, when I use those terms, I really use it to talk about the change in viewer relationships. So I haven't really considered it from the perspective that you're mentioning, but it's an interesting perspective. Because when I started as an artist, we were still in a kind of viewer relationship, and it was still kind of the transcendental subject, even though we had performance and all of that stuff, but you were supposed to have this experience. I did many times in front of a painting, and
preferably an abstract expressionist painting.
Yeah, or but also, you know, I went to Europe as a teenager, and I couldn't believe it. You know, I never had seen, you know, work like that in such abundance. And then gradually we had the spectator, and then gradually we had the user of the work, which is what happens when you make an installation, I think. So that you become, you're much more actively constructing the meaning of the work. But in terms of the kind of relationship that you're setting out, you know, I think that could, you know, that could be a way of describing it. You know, but I think that there's more that happens than just those three relations. For instance, at the auction, where, and then how many people have been to an auction? Have you been to an auction? Yeah. So you really feel the tension of people's desire. It's like very intense, and it's palpable. You can really feel that someone wants this work, even if everyone's sitting with their paddles and going up and down. And so it's not, you know, it's not, it's a certain kind of user, but it's also a very particular emotional relationship with a lot at stake. And I think there are lots of viewing conventions where there's a lot at stake. I mean, even being in an opening, and I had my first opening was actually in Belgium. I think you even might have been there. And I remember spending that entire afternoon, it went on from, I think it was noon until 6, the bathroom. There were collectors there that seemed to want something. Mm-hmm. And I had never really been in an experience where I was around collectors where they wanted something from me. And I felt like when I would walk out there, it was terrifying. Mm-hmm. And I spent the whole afternoon in the bathroom. Oh, okay, the trust thing. Yeah, that's a difficult one. And, you know, I think even if you're interviewing in the U.S., if you're going into a community where they don't know you, you have to establish trust. And that takes a long time. So you can't, you know, parachute in and out of these places. You really have to be trusted by the community. You need people in the community to vouch for you. And then you need to live up to what they vouched for. Meaning, in the case of Cairo Stories, everyone was paid. There was not one person who did an interview who was not paid. Mm-hmm. The translators were paid. The interlocutors were paid. Everybody was paid very, very fairly and always. And similarly, they were allowed access to the stories if they wanted to hear them. I let them, you know. So it was very open-ended in terms of, you know, what could happen to those tapes and how they might be used. And everybody signed a release. But it said very clearly that their name would not be mentioned or associated with the story, that it would be kept private, and so forth and so on. So, but it took a while to put that structure into place.
It sounds like you're playing the role of an analyst to some extent, and that this actually places the viewer mm-hmm. in that position partially as well.
Yeah, well, there is
a kind
know.
I don't know how to make anything of that, or maybe it's the opposite, you know. But, when bringing up this question of trust, of course, mm-hmm. which has to be built, and then listening to the intimate story and mm-hmm. the insurance of confidentiality.
Well, and also the, you know, during the interviews, they weren't scripted.
I keep knocking this thing off.
And it's hard to keep it on my ear. So that we would let the interview go in whatever direction the interviewee wanted to take it. And sometimes they would say, no, this is too personal, I can't tell you
that's
this. Or the translator has to leave mm-hmm. the room because she's Egyptian, and I don't want anybody in Egypt to hear this story, but you can hear it because you don't live here. Mm. And, you know, so we often get things like that. So, yeah, it was very personal and very particular.
Yeah.
And there was...
That's intimate,
yeah,
really intimate.
Yeah, it was very, very intimate.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't...
This is Iggy.
Yes.
I actually had a question about the point Rosalind just made, that it seems as if you're taking the role of an analyst, and mm-hmm. actually wanted to ask you about the role of listening in this work. Mm. And particularly listening seems to me as something that's left out of actions that qualify as mm-hmm. political. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the work,
yes.
I think, that really fleshes out the role of listening, of mm-hmm. receiving,
responding, listening.
And right. listening, like Adam Phillips often writes about the analyst, yes. as creating the silence of the analyst is actually dialogical in mm-hmm. many ways. It generates something in the transaction between the speaker and the analyst. And I wanted to know if you could talk more about that, but also it struck me that the role the actors play is very interesting, because they're simultaneously bearing a witness, they're responsible, they become mm-hmm. responsible for the others, and it's a way of speaking that's simultaneously one of listening, mm-hmm. and I think that's a really interesting trope, or a really interesting instance, with so the zone between speaking and bearing testimony also becomes mm-hmm. a zone of listening, mm-hmm. and I wonder mm-hmm. if you could talk more about those dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question.
That's great.
And thank you for that, because listening was a very big part of this project. And the idea was, to some extent, who has the right to a voice, but also the corollary, who has the right to be heard or listened to. And every story actually is a story where you have a story, but you need a listener in order for the story to be completed. And so I've done a number of projects about the voice and the use of the voice, and for this project in particular, I thought this is a project where listening is critical, and asking those questions about who has the right to a listener is really something that I wanted to foreground. And I agree with you, I think the actors really do make a case for the listener listening, because they're... Once you know they're actors, you can kind of see the acting, and you can see the act of acting, listening at the same time.
And you mentioned Adam Phillips, who actually calls psychoanalysis the listening cure, by contrast with the talking cure.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh.
And, you know, and the analytic relationship is a performative one.
Yeah. Yeah, but thanks for noticing that. That's
a really rich avenue.
Yeah.
Sure.
Thank you. This was a very interesting question and a very interesting response, and I wanted to explore that dimension more by asking more technical questions, and that is I'm interested in the whole process. That you start, of course, establishing trust, listening, but I'd like to know how exactly the situation is. For example, if we were talking about the analyst does not look at the patient, the analyst mm-hmm. is behind the patient. So where are you in space when you do the interview? That's one thing. Do you record the interview? Do you film the interview or only the sound?
Good. Only the sound. That was.
And then, what is? Let us say, I mean, the expression is probably inadequate, but let us say that this is your raw material, and then the end product will be what we see here in the gallery, and in the process, the actors or the actresses have to interpret the material. So is there an editing of the interview? Is there a montage of the interview? Do you change the order of mm-hmm. paragraphs or something like that? What is the degree of artificiality that you called, if I remember, a built-in distanciation? I love mm-hmm. that expression that you used. So could you be very concrete about the process?
Yeah. Well, I used, you know, because these were, you know, I knew going into it that people did not want to have their picture taken. So immediately doing a video shoot with them would have been impossible. Also, there's something about having a camera shoved in your face that does not make you want to reveal anything. So I also knew that I didn't really want to do that because of the problem of the camera, just in general, when you're going for something that's more intimate. So I used a very low budget tape recorder, like old reel-to-reel, not reel-to-reel, but cassette tape. It was about this big. And we had two or three microphones, and we simply had the microphones on the table, or sometimes we would pass them around. And the interviews usually took place in people's homes, which made them feel comfortable. So whenever we could, we would go to a person's house, even if that meant traveling, you know, 3 hours to get there across Cairo because the traffic is so dreadful. But, you know, I wouldn't try to do 10 interviews in one day. I would try to do one interview in a day. And so I would stay for, you know, quite a long time. I would rent an apartment and just be there for a month or 6 weeks. And so that's how they were collected. And then we would make copies of the tapes just so we would have a backup copy right away. And then after that, I would transcribe them, or, you know, some of the translators would transcribe them. And so we had them transcribed. And we would also usually meet with the interlocutors to talk about the subject matter in the interview, and also to talk about it in terms of its veracity, meaning, you know, is this really, could this really be true, or, you know, what does she mean when she says X? And because, you know, not being from the culture, I really wanted to understand exactly what I was hearing. And then based on those relationships and this group of women that I came to trust over so many years of working there, together we developed which stories would go all the way to be filmed and which we would not do. And in most cases, we did change some of the order and we excised certain things. It was very important that they not be longer than 4 or 5 minutes because people won't listen. And so we kind of would cut them down, but most of them are really accurate to the kernel of the story. So in other words, we didn't combine, you know, a bunch of different stories together to make it more dramatic. Like we said, at the outset we said, okay, we're not going to do that. I mean, we could have, but we just decided that that was not true to the project. And so they actually are kind of one story per actor, or one, you know, one character, and they're fairly accurate to the recording, even if the recording was as long as an hour. And some of the subjects we interviewed more than once. Like some people wanted to come back and talk about something that they talked about, and because they wanted to clarify it, you know, they felt a little exposed and they would want to come back, and so we would go back there and have another interview with them, even if it was 6 months later or something. And so, you know, so it was a whole team. And as I said, I really do think that I see them as collaborations. I mean, I could not have invented these stories. I couldn't have known about a lot of the stuff that I know about. And so I really do think they're collaborative. And these kinds of projects, I think, let you slide out a little bit of that auteur relationship that you're sort of stuck with as an artist. It's your art, and your name
artiste has to
be on it. And this project is a little different than that. Although there's not a really good word, because facilitator has problems. I mean, there's no good word for it. But so, you know, interlocutor is probably the most neutral word right now to use to describe the process for me, but that was the process. And then, as I said, I brought as many people as I could over to the U.S. to work on the project that I was working with, because I wanted them around and I kind of needed them, and they graciously came. But that was quite a production to bring them over, especially then. But anyway, so that's how it came to be.